Ghost Platoon, Operation Frequent Wind, by Fred H. Allison, from the Leatherneck, May 2016, read by Colonel Timothy S. Mundy, U.S. Marine Corps, retired. Much has been written, and rightly so, about the brave Marines, both air and ground, who dramatically evacuated civilians from the American Embassy in Saigon on April 29, 1975, as the North Vietnamese overran the city. Little has been said, however, about a platoon of Marines snuck into the Defense Attaché Office, DAO, in Saigon 4 days prior to the 29th to provide security during the evacuation. Indeed, it was at the DAO, next to Tan Son Nhut Air Base, where most of the evacuations occurred before the final dramatic day and actually on the final day itself. This is the account of the Leathernecks of 3rd Platoon, 1st Battalion, 9th Marine Regiment, who provided security for these evacuations in those last days. They were a ghost platoon. No one was supposed to know they were there. They were a stabilizing force in a most volatile environment that allowed thousands to be efficiently evacuated before the city fell into the hands of a menacing enemy that was literally at the gates. Saigon Evacuation. The young woman stood at the gate of the DAO and begged Lance Corporal Glenn Picon to allow her into the compound. Quote, "She offered herself in bondage to me if I would help her," end quote, recounted Picon. "She said she would be my slave for 10 years if I would help her and her family get out. I told her there was nothing I could do. I couldn't help. She just sat down on the street in front of the gate and said, 'Then shoot me now.'" In the spring of 1975, South Vietnam began to unravel. The balance of power had tipped in favor of the North Vietnamese, and they unleashed a full-blown invasion of South Vietnam. There were thousands of American citizens, third-party nationals, and South Vietnamese who were friends of the United States and faced an unknown and predictably dire future under a communist regime. Da Nang precipitously fell at the end of March, and on April 20th, after fierce fighting, the North Vietnamese Army, NVA, captured the defensive strong point at Juan Lac. This placed the NVA within 40 miles of Saigon. With little to stop them, the communists surged toward Saigon, determined to have final victory by the end of the month. A week later, the city was encircled by 17 NVA divisions, and the shelling of the city commenced. As the communists closed in, evacuations began with fixed-wing aircraft, both military and civilian, from Tan Son Nhut Air Base on the western outskirts of Saigon. The evacuation flights increased in number as the communists drew near. By April 21st, transport aircraft fully loaded with civilians were departing Tan Son Nhut every half hour. The urgency of the situation could not be overstated. On April 22nd, the Defense Intelligence Agency reported that communist forces were in position to launch a final offensive, and it would almost certainly be successful. The DAO, nicknamed Pentagon East, sat next to Tan Son Nhut and was the command center for Southeast Asia operations. The largest American military headquarters in the world outside of the Pentagon, it was the processing point for the evacuees departing South Vietnam from Tan Son Nhut. The DAO represented the last bastion of American power and presence. It became the lifeline for civilians hoping to exit South Vietnam before it became Communist Vietnam. A simmering panic permeated Saigon's atmosphere. Civilians flooded into the DAO hoping to get a ticket out of their homeland. The DAO had very little in the way of security forces. The U.S. had been limited to only 50 military personnel in country by the 1973 Paris Peace Accords, and those personnel were not at the DAO. It was guarded by a handful of retired South Vietnamese soldiers and police. Although the South Vietnamese civilians on site generally were friendly and well-behaved, it was nevertheless a worrisome situation. The crowds created confusion, and the people roamed freely over the grounds, which imperiled security. The DAO was not equipped or staffed to handle such crowds. Sanitation facilities and provisions were not adequate. To bolster security, a detachment of Marines from the security guard contingent at the American Embassy was shifted to the DAO. As the crowds increased and the communists closed in, it was apparent more security was needed. The DAO staff lobbied the American ambassador, Graham A. Martin, for more Marines. Martin, concerned about violating the manpower ceiling, resisted their pleas. He finally relented, but as one Marine on the DAO staff said, they had a hell of a time getting the ambassador to do it. There was a special stipulation concerning the Marines. They had to be inserted stealthily, since they in fact did violate the Paris Peace Accord's manpower ceiling. Once permission was granted, a 40-man platoon from the Battalion Landing Team, 1st Battalion 9th Marine Regiment, BLT-19, which was a reserve battalion for the 9th Marine Amphibious Brigade, 9th MAB, was given the mission. First Lieutenant Bruce P. Thompson Bowers, the executive officer for Charlie Company, was put in command. He was the only junior officer in the battalion who had combat experience. He had served as an enlisted Marine with 3rd Battalion 26th Marines in 1967 in Vietnam. Thompson Bowers selected the 3rd Platoon of Charlie Company for the unusual mission. They were a close-knit bunch with good morale and positive attitudes, but they were young, and for most of them, this was their first deployment. One of the platoon members, Ray Fawcett, recalled, "We were always told that we were one of the best and tightest platoons they had seen in years. We knew what each other were thinking and could react without saying anything. Our whole platoon had a close bond. When we went in there, we knew we were going to watch over one another and somehow get back out." Private First Class Fawcett recalled being rousted out of the rack at Camp Schwab, Okinawa, at 0200 and told to pack his bags. The battalion was convoyed to the U.S. Air Base at Kadena, Okinawa, and flown by Air Force C-141s to the Naval Air Station, Cubey Point, Philippines. They arrived on April 5th, only 27 hours after the initial alert. Leathernecks of BLT-19 went aboard USS Hancock, CVA-19, which had been fast routed from the West Coast. She sailed from Cubey Point on April 9th, bound for the coast of South Vietnam. Once underway, Thompson Bowers began focused training with 3rd Platoon. He emphasized crowd control techniques, handling large numbers of people with restraint and not losing one's cool or overreacting. He trained his Marines in searches and how to find hidden weapons. He obtained units of blood from the ship's medical staff to enhance training realism. Sailors played the role of civilians, some with blood-soaked bandages. Some had hidden weapons and acted disorderly and threatening. They trained for about 2 weeks while Hancock sailed and stood off the coast of South Vietnam. On the evening of April 24th, Thompson Bowers passed the word to his Marines, "Tomorrow we go into Saigon. Get ready." The next morning, they assembled on Hancock's hangar deck. The Marines were told to strip out of their utilities and change into civilian clothes that had been donated by the ship's sailors. Once attired in civilian garb, they packed their utilities, 782 gear, weapons, and ammunition, and boarded 6 Air America Silver and Blue UH-1 helicopters. As they loaded on the helicopters on the deserted flight deck, they were told no cameras. The helicopters flew them from the ship to Son Son Nut in a flight of less than an hour. A Central Intelligence Agency bus drove them across the road to the DAO compound. The compound was an expansive complex stretching over a few city blocks. The main building, ominously codenamed the Alamo, was multi-storied, rectangular-shaped with multiple wings, all concrete. Classic 1950s government architecture. It contained the main headquarters and the evacuation command center. The annex was the outlying part of the DAO and contained a number of smaller structures, including a post exchange, bowling alley, swimming pool, and a gymnasium. The atmosphere in the complex was one of focused activity. People were in a hurry, but not panicked. The compound was teeming with South Vietnamese civilians, more than 2,000 people hoping to be evacuated. Smoke on the horizon evidenced the close proximity of the North Vietnamese battalions in battle with South Vietnamese troops. The Marines were directed to their quarters, a large building in the annex with cots arranged on the floor. This was their home for the next 4 days. They stripped out of the civilian clothes and donned their utilities and strapped on their gear. First Lieutenant Thompson Bowers had not been given a 5-paragraph order or specific instructions for the mission. No one knew what was going to happen, he remembered. His first action was to report in at the command bunker. He was briefed by the DAO and various leaders, including the defense attaché officer, Major General Homer G. Smith, Jr., United States Army, Brigadier General Richard E. Carey, commanding the 9th MAB, and Colonel Alfred M. Gray, the future 29th Commandant, commanding Regimental Landing Team 4. Thompson Bowers recalled that they all told him basically the same thing. "We need security for this place. Your job is to provide it." Thompson Bowers obtained a jeep and reconnoitered the DAO grounds. He investigated the roads, buildings, fences, perimeter, and developed a plan. He identified points to establish checkpoints and outposts, entryways and exits, then assigned Marines to each. He ordered them to stick to the Rules of Engagement, ROE. The ROE restricted but did not prohibit the use of force and allowed an escalation of force if needed. One of the Marines, Lance Corporal Carl Stroud, recalled arriving at the DAO. "I was pretty scared when we arrived. This is out of my element. It was chaotic and crazy. We were put on different posts and told, stay here until I come back. You did pretty much as you were told." Not only did the platoon not have specific instructions, they had no supplies or resupply except for ammunition. They discovered a post exchange on the grounds, but it was closed. The 3rd Platoon Marines pried the doors open and went, quote, shopping, end quote, helping themselves to the canned goods on the shelves. This remained their source of food. Although a cyclone fence defined the perimeter, there were gaps that allowed easy access to the grounds, especially around the annex. Thompson Bowers asked the DAO staff members to leave the keys in the cars, which they did. They were never going to need them again anyway. The Marines used the autos like HESCO barriers, positioning them to make obstacles and roadblocks and channel the crowds. Thus, access was limited to the guard stations where the Marines stood post. They manned their posts 24 hours a day, rotating shifts. Otherwise, their main function devolved into handling civilians and preparing the lucky ones for evacuation. The civilians were housed in the bowling alley, sleeping on the lanes. It was overcrowded and miserable. The plumbing and sewers could not handle the extra use and backed up, fouling the building. The civilians were fed sea rations twice a day, although hot food was provided eventually. After a couple of days, the Marines and police conducted a sweep to move those without the right credentials out of the compound. When discovered, the unlucky ones were asked to leave. Thompson Bowers recalled most did so quietly. They joined the throngs outside the compound, hoping to get a way out. The gym was where immigration personnel had tables set up for processing. The tennis court was the staging point for the bus trip to the airport. When processed, the civilians were given a number, which was their ticket to board an outbound aircraft. Corporal Mike Dalrymple organized loading groups for buses that would take civilians from the DAO to the airport. "The Vietnamese would bring me rosters and I would review it," he recalled. "It was funny because the roster would have 30 names, but there would be up to 50 Vietnamese in the group. How was I to know who's who? Who am I to say? I would let them all go. They would all get on the airplane. They appeared to be all family. They knew each other, one tight little group." The 3rd Platoon Marines stood guard duty at the gates that accessed the DAO. It was bitter duty. Hundreds of civilians thronged around the DAO. "There were so many people begging and pleading to be saved, and we just couldn't do anything to help them," Lance Corporal Calvin Johnson recalled. "That's what hurts." At night, the Marines remained on post and patrolled around the compound. There were no regular hours. Sleep was precious and often interrupted by emergency calls for assistance or enemy fire. 16-hour days were the norm. Marines are known for their aggression in combat. In this case, it was more important to be aggressively restrained. Sporadic fire hit around the compound. Lance Corporal Jimmy Sanchez recalled that fire was coming in. Artillery, rockets, mortars. We just had to take it. We couldn't fire back. While many of the Army of Republic of Vietnam, ARVN, troops, performed bravely and responsibly, Thompson Bowers recalled, most worrisome were the Army of Vietnam soldiers. They were posted around the city, including just outside the DAO. Some were deserters and had donned civilian clothes. They brandished their weapons threateningly and took pot shots at the DAO as if to show that they were loyal communists now. Gary Dave recalled, we feared the South Vietnamese. They had on U.S. Army uniforms. We didn't trust them. We asked the lieutenant and he told us to lock and load. Although the ROE would have allowed an escalation of force, the Marines were disciplined and resisted retaliation. Brigadier General Carey, in an official debrief at headquarters U.S. Marine Corps, shortly after, reported that not a single retaliatory round was fired by Marines during the evacuation. Thompson Bowers said it was a good thing. Had any one of them, my Marines, overreacted, it would have been a complete bloodbath. Operation Frequent Wind. Rocket fire lashed Thanh Son Nhut on the evening of April 28th. It was perceptibly heavier and more intense. The Marines were amazed to see three captured South Vietnamese Air Force A-37s bomb Thanh Son Nhut. In the early morning darkness of the 29th, a barrage of well-aimed rocket, artillery, and mortar rounds smashed into the DAO. Thompson Bowers remembered that this was an especially aggressive attack. It was like the NVA said, it's time to go home, time's up. One rocket hit a C-130 cargo aircraft scheduled to load evacuees, causing it to erupt in flames and foul a runway. This ended the fixed-wing evacuations. When the barrage hit the DAO, Marines scrambled for cover. Most dove into a ditch along the perimeter. Jimmy Sanchez recalled that Thompson Bowers drove up in a Jeep and called for two Marines to go with him. As they drove away, an artillery round impacted close enough to blow the rear end of the Jeep up, causing loss of control but no injuries. One rocket made a direct hit on a guard post where Corporal Charles McMahon, Jr. and Lance Corporal Darwin D. Judge, part of the Embassy Marine Security Guard Detachment, stood guard. They were killed instantly. Thompson Bowers rushed to the scene and found the crater where the rocket had hit. He saw a blown-apart rifle with McMahon's serial number on it. Otherwise, there was not enough of the body to identify. Judge's body was found nearby. Thompson Bowers reported the deaths in the command bunker. Shortly after, Option 4, the helicopter evacuation, was announced. Frequent Wind was the last hope to get out of Saigon. As First Lieutenant Thompson Bowers rushed out of the DAO to prepare his troops, he passed through the quarterdeck. He noticed an American flag and a South Vietnamese flag on display. He thought the DAO would not be around much longer, so he took them down, folded them, and placed them into a satchel. At mid-morning, Platoon Guide Sergeant James DeMoy moved among the Marines and told them to lock and load and quietly move back to the platoon's headquarters. On the way, they were to lock and secure all gates behind them without arousing the Vietnamese people. With his platoon gathered around, First Lieutenant Thompson Bowers told them that President Gerald R. Ford had announced the final evacuation and that BLT-2-4 was to be inserted to assist with security. Until BLT-2-4 took over, they would continue to process evacuees and get them ready to load on the CH-53s. He told them to load 50 people per aircraft. They were to also relax the standards for paperwork identification. With those instructions, the Ghost Platoon Marines returned to their post. They resumed their duties at crowd control and organized loading groups for the helicopter evacuation. Five landing zones, LZs, had been pre-selected where evacuees would load into the big CH-53 helicopters from Marine Heavy Helicopter Squadron 462 and HMH-463 augmented by 10 U.S. Air Force CH-53s, all coming from ships of Task Force 76, about 20 miles off the coast. Almost 700 evacuees were pre-staged to load into the first wave of helicopters due to begin at mid-afternoon. Until then, the crowds grew larger and more desperate around the compound. A mother with a baby begged Lance Corporal Johnson for entrance into the compound. All I could do was ask her to please leave the area. Then she begged him to shoot her and her baby. She said it would be a much easier death than what the communists would give them. Others handed their babies over the fence. The Marines took them. Thompson Bowers told his men to put them on the ground. They hoped they would be picked up by the outbound civilians. Other anxious citizens tossed their infants over the fence to civilians standing in the processing lines. Keeping the crowd under control and orderly was of paramount concern. One Marine recalled, "Rounds were coming in and the civilians took cover in the ditches along the side. I shouted to them that no one was going anywhere until they got themselves straightened out and to get in single file. They generally were orderly and compliant. Other people roaming around would come up, some were Arvin, and they tried to shove their way into the lines. We told them they couldn't go. Evacuees were told they could carry only a single bag." Another Marine recalled, "One guy tried to cut in line. He was waving a religious symbol. I slapped the out of him, and he got the idea." In another incident, a Marine at one of the perimeter gates was threatened by a man with a gun. The Marine held his ground, so the man defiantly, but still threatening, backed off. Lance Corporal Billy Carmichael, 19 years old, later recalled that conditions outside bordered on chaos. People clamored to get into the compound and in a loading group. He was offered money and barter. He said, "I was afraid and scared, but we had a mission and we had to complete it." Another gentleman offered Lance Corporal Donnie Yater $100,000 if Yater would smuggle him into the compound. "He had the money right there," Yater said. "There was nothing I could do," and he went away crying. At 15:06, the first wave of Marine helicopters arrived to begin the evacuation. With them came the lead elements of BLT-24, a powerful security force that would ensure that the high-volume evacuation operations would go as smoothly as possible. Until BLT-24 got into position and oriented, 3rd Platoon Marines loaded the helicopters. Corporal Dalrymple said, "Lieutenant Thompson Bowers told me, 'When you see the choppers, throw your smoke and bring them in. Start landing them. And put the people on the choppers until relieved by the 4th Marines.' I must have loaded 10 choppers on my own before they got there." Once relieved of their security and evacuation duties, 3rd Platoon boarded one of the HMH 462 helicopters. Thompson Bowers recalled, "I was exhausted, but my biggest fear was leaving someone behind. I spoke to the crew chief, 'Do not let this airplane take off until I get a good head count.' I got it and gave the crew chief a thumbs up." The crew chief sat on the rear left side of the ramp. At his feet was an opened box of thermite grenades, decoys he would toss out in case an SA-7, surface-to-air heat-seeking missile, man portable, was fired at the helicopter. He had good reason to carry them. Throughout the afternoon, helicopter crews reported being fired on. For the Marines, the flight out was an emotional roller coaster. First Lieutenant Thompson Bowers remembered, "I was glad it was over. We had suffered no casualties, but I was overcome with the sense that the entire war was all for nothing." Sanchez recalled, "When we were up in the air, we saw the enemy just outside of Saigon." A sergeant said, "We are not in the clear yet. They could fire around and knock us out of the sky. I want everyone to say a prayer." So we all hung our heads and said a silent prayer. When we got over the ocean, I said, "Thank God it's over." Mike Dalrymple sat next to Thompson Bowers. When they crossed over the beach and out over the water, Dalrymple told him, "I will never forget you." The lieutenant turned and said, "Mike, the weight of the world is off my shoulders because none of you were killed." Landing on board Hancock, the Marines found the ship was inundated with refugees. Most had been delivered by Marine helicopters, but many others got there on their own. The flight deck was chaotic as commandeered helicopters flown by South Vietnamese landed on any available deck with their cargo of family and friends. Once landed and unloaded, the deck crew had no choice but to heave the helicopters overboard to clear a landing space for Marine helicopters. Ray Fawcett recalled that once on board, they were admonished by officers to keep quiet about their mission, quote, because of the whole deal about the peace treaty, end quote. They headed to their compartments only to find them occupied. Mike Dalrymple recalled, "We had no compartment. They were taken over by the Vietnamese. They were already there. There were people everywhere, masses of people, the hangar bay, the lower compartments, the flight deck, everywhere. Despite the overcrowding, there were no problems. The sailors and Marines were considerate and gracious, while the South Vietnamese were friendly, polite, and extremely grateful." Evacuations from the DAO ceased at 2040 on April 29th. In 5.5 hours, about 120 helicopter sorties evacuated 395 Americans and 4,475 refugees from the DAO during Operation Frequent Wind, the final day's evacuations. These evacuation operations, as well as those that occurred in previous days, which resulted in more than 40,000 people being evacuated, occurred in an orderly and efficient manner. The 9th MAB's after-action report characterized the DAO operation as, quote, sterling, end quote. The 3rd Platoon, Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, the Ghost Platoon, was mentioned in the AAR. Quote, "This platoon, operating under the most trying of circumstances from 26 April, had been subjected to incoming artillery and rocket fire until relieved at 1600 29 April," end quote. Brigadier General Carey, the 9th MAB's commanding general, in an official Headquarters Marine Corps debrief, noted their importance. Quote, "Under 1st Lieutenant Thompson Bowers, security was no longer a real problem. They were subjected to and harassed by small arms, mortar, and artillery fire, but continued to perform as Marines within the ROE. They performed superbly," end quote. It was a bittersweet mission for the 3rd Platoon Marines. Lance Corporal Picone recalled the best part of the mission for the Marines. "It was really beautiful seeing the people who got out. Once we'd get the lucky ones inside the compound and onto a plane, you'd see some damned happy people." It was also bitter, Corporal Larry Price recalled. "But it's hard to think about those who couldn't go. They were the most desperate people I have ever seen." Thompson Bowers kept the flags he rescued from the DAO. In the following years, every April 29th, he pulled them out and remembered that day. In 2010, he decided they belonged to the Marine Corps, and he, along with other members of 3rd Platoon, on the occasion of their first reunion since 1975, donated the flags to the National Museum of the Marine Corps in Triangle, Virginia. Author's bio. Major Fred Allison, U.S. Marine Corps Reserve, retired, is a former Marine F-4 radar intercept officer. He earned his doctorate in history from Texas Tech University and currently is a historian at the Marine Corps History Division, Quantico, Virginia.